Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Last week, we learned that the FBI obtained a secret court order in the summer of 2016 to monitor the communications of Carter Page, a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. This is big news. The FBI and the Justice Department got this order by convincing a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, better known as a FISA court, that there was probable cause to believe that Page was acting as an agent of a foreign power, namely Russia. This wasn't the first run-in with the FBI for Page, a wannabe wheeler-dealer in Russian energy markets. In 2013, he cooperated with the Bureau in its investigation of a Russian spy ring. Page admitted that he gave documents to the accused spies, though he insisted that what he handed over was legal to share, and Page was not charged. My guest today is Liza Goitein, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center. Before that, she was counsel to Senator Russ Feingold, and before that, she was a lawyer for the Justice Department. She's here today to talk about the inner workings of the FISA court. Liza, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
What would the authorities have to know about Carter Page or someone like him in order to get a FISA warrant?
The FBI would have to show to the FISA court that it had probable cause to believe that Carter Page was an agent of a foreign power. And an agent of a foreign power, if that person is a U.S. citizen, as Carter Page is, would have to be someone who is knowingly engaged in espionage on behalf of a foreign power or is knowingly engaging in sabotage or in international terrorism on behalf of a foreign power, someone who knowingly entered the United States under a false identity on behalf of a foreign power. I think that's clearly not Carter Page. Or who knowingly helped someone in those activities. And it's basically, in the case of Carter Page, I think you would have to assume that they're looking at potential espionage, potential clandestine intelligence activities that he would have been performing on behalf of Russia.
And we know that he was in the orbit of accused Russian spies, charged Russian spies as early as 2011 before he even came into the Trump orbit, that they've got the alleged spies on tape saying that, that they'd promised him a share in a Russian oil deal if he came up with documents.
That's right. And we know that he has said in the past that he, has been cooperating with the FBI and that he never passed on any important information to the Russians, et cetera, et cetera. But there's certainly enough of a background here, and it's not surprising to me necessarily that the FBI was able to get a FISA warrant on him.
So could you describe a bit about how the FISA system works and why it was set up the way it is?
Sure. The FISA system was set up in 1978 after the Church Committee discovered that multiple administrations had been routinely abusing surveillance authorities to target political enemies or personal enemies or social justice movements, disfavored minorities and ideologies, that kind of thing. So they set up a system where the government, if it wanted to conduct surveillance of international communications between foreigners overseas and Americans, would have to go to a special court, the FISA court, which operates in secret, and basically get a warrant, would have to show probable cause that the target was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power, which in the case of an American would mean essentially that they were engaging in espionage or similar activities. And then the court would either issue the order or not issue the order, and surveillance could happen. What happened over time is that after 9/11, President Bush started ignoring FISA and conducting warrantless surveillance of communications between foreigners overseas and Americans when there was some suspicion of terrorism. And when this was revealed, instead of essentially censuring the president for doing this, Congress legalized that program through something called the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed in 2008. So now, if the government wants to collect information and communications between a foreign target overseas and an American, it doesn't have to get an individual order from the FISA court. And in fact, the target doesn't have to be a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. It can be any foreigner overseas.
So what's the advantage of going down the FISA route if it's suddenly been legalized to allow people to collect information in that much more broad and warrantless way?
Right. So warrantless surveillance under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act is permitted only if the target is reasonably believed to be a foreigner overseas. So if, in fact, the target is an American, as is the case with Carter Page, they have to go through the more rigorous process of appealing to the FISA court in an individual case to show that the person, there's probable cause that the person is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. That's also the case when the government wants to conduct surveillance of a diplomat or, you know, someone from a foreign embassy. They also have to get an individualized FISA court order.
So it's not true that the communications of embassies are routinely screened by U.S. intelligence?
Oh, no. The communications of embassies are routinely screened. That is certainly the case. They just have to proceed under a different authority than they would in the case of a foreigner overseas.
So I guess I'm confused about what routine surveillance means then. I mean, do they just do it as a matter of course and have authorization? They just say, well, it's reasonable that anybody at the embassy would be agents of foreign powers.
I'm not sure. I can't say for sure that they conduct surveillance of every single person at every foreign embassy. But certainly if you have a Russian ambassador in this country, and that's a country with whom we have had tense relations in recent years, and we have certainly had an interest in knowing what their communications are, that you could expect, for example, that Kislyak would be subject to surveillance by the NSA.
So when Acting Attorney General Sally Yates came forward and said that she was concerned that former National Security Advisor Flynn might be being blackmailed because of his conversations with Kislyak, what kind of authorization do you think she had for listening into those conversations?
So those conversations were reportedly intercepted Kislyak himself was the target of those conversations. And as I mentioned, it's fairly routine for the NSA to conduct surveillance of foreign agents such as Kislyak in this instance. And his conversations with Flynn would have just been among the many conversations that he had that were being picked up. So it's not as if Flynn himself was being targeted and collecting these conversations. His end of the conversation was collected incidentally. That's the term that's used by the government when that person is not himself the target.
Why do you think Flynn didn't know that that would have been happening?
It's a good question. He certainly should have known. Maybe he just wasn't familiar with the law that governs surveillance. It seems like a lot of people seem to have been taken by surprise, even members of Congress who have repeatedly voted for the laws that allow this kind of surveillance seem surprised to learn that it could happen.
This is something else that I was wondering about in terms of Jeff Sessions' confirmation process, because he said that he hadn't had any contacts with Russian officials when Al Franken specifically asked him during his confirmation hearing. And would that be normal? I mean, one of those was a meeting in his office where his staff would have seen him and been involved in it. Wouldn't his staff have, as a matter of course, briefed him before an attorney general confirmation hearing about whether he'd been in contact with any foreign officials like that?
It is puzzling, the answer that he gave. It certainly seems like maybe he wasn't being entirely forthcoming about, you know, what he knew. But I suppose there's a chance. I mean, he certainly would have met with many, many ambassadors over the course of a year. And, you know, I suppose theoretically possible that this one slipped his mind. I think, you know, you have to sort of leave that up to the public in terms of what they think of Sessions and his fitness to be the attorney general. But then that's another matter for the FBI in looking at some of these contacts.
These kinds of warrants are separate from criminal warrants. You don't have to show probable cause that someone's about to commit an espionage-related crime, right? What kind of standards of evidence do apply for deciding whether someone's an agent of a foreign power in the relevant sense?
So the level of proof is the same. It has to be probable cause. It's true that what you're trying to show is somewhat different. You're not trying to show that they are guilty of a particular federal crime. However, the definition of agent of a foreign power in the statute as applied to U.S. persons, which is residents, legal residents or citizens of the United States, that definition essentially implies criminal activity. You can't really knowingly conduct espionage or clandestine intelligence activities on behalf of a foreign power or knowingly engage in sabotage or terrorism on behalf of a foreign power without violating a law. So, you know, in some ways, it comes close to being a criminal warrant in terms of what needs to be proved.
There are ways of legally registering to be an agent of a foreign power, right? That would not be considered criminal if you're in the foreign agents registration database as working for a foreign entity. That would be legal, right?
Well, that's different. There's the agent of a foreign power as defined in FISA is quite different from foreign agent as defined in the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So these are two different concepts. As I said before, being an agent of a foreign power for purposes of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act implies some level of criminality. That is not the case in terms of registering to be a foreign agent under the FARA statute. In that case, you merely have to be representing a foreign country, a foreign organization, a foreign entity, and sort of representing that entity in its political activities or representing it to the United States in some way. So it's a very different definition. It's perfectly legal to be a foreign agent. However, you have to register and you have to disclose those activities. And there is a narrow set of people for whom it is not legal to be acting as an agent, as a foreign agent. And those are essentially people who are currently involved in government.
How does one come to be a FISA judge? Who decides that someone's qualified?
FISA judges are actually sitting district court judges. They are judges who have already been appointed and are serving life terms on various courts around the country. And then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court chooses those judges to spend a part of their time every year coming to Washington and sitting on the FISA court. And they sit for 7-year terms, and then they go back to their regular judgeships.
And they only serve 1 week out of every 11 in D.C. being like the duty FISA judge, right?
That's right. That's right. And again, it's only just for 1 7-year term. It cannot be renewed.
Why did Congress decide to set FISA up as a kind of side gig?
Well, I think that Congress wanted to have judges in place who they knew were qualified and who could become experts in these issues and develop a specialization in these issues without losing the perspective of being an ordinary judge in ordinary cases, so that they wouldn't be so much in their own world and echo chamber that they would lose touch with the sort of general principles of law that they're applying in other contexts. I think it was a pretty good way of doing it if you were going to have a specialized court like this.
Do you think it's a good idea on the whole to have a specialized court like that?
I'm not convinced that it's necessary. There's a mythology around national security issues that they're somehow more complicated and more difficult and incomprehensible than any other field, such that you have to have this unique specialization in order to really understand these issues. And, you know, I don't see that borne out in any of the national security matters that, for example, were classified at one time and then became unclassified so you could read about them. You know, there are so many cases that are incredibly complicated factually as well as legally that we entrust our federal courts to decide on a daily basis. You know, toxic chemical spills and litigation around very complicated scientific matters, you know, any number of cases in which courts have to wrap their minds around some difficult concepts. And there are tools that courts can use. They can use special masters, for example. They can call in their own experts to advise them. It's never been clear to me why national security has a sort of magical sheen to it that it has to have an entirely different court to handle it.
Is it just the Chief Justice's opinion of who's qualified to be a FISA judge, or is there some objective standard in terms of training or proficiency that they have to demonstrate in order to have this responsibility?
No, there's no particular standard, and I don't think there should be a standard. I think the proficiency they should have is an ability to apply the law to the facts of the case, and that's what judges do all the time. So again, I think it kind of plays into this idea that national security is somehow different from everything else, to think that the judges would have to have special training in order to do this job. I think, you know, there is an issue in terms of there may be some self-selection among the judges who want this job. I mean, they're generally speaking, the Chief Justice is not going to appoint somebody to this position who really doesn't want it. So it may self-select for people who come in with a particular viewpoint. And in the past, there have been cases where there was a period of time during which the Chief Justice was appointing almost all Republican judges, by which I mean judges who were initially appointed by Republican presidents, but that has changed. So, you know, it's not a perfect process by any means.
Doesn't it kind of undercut the argument that they need special expertise if they're just appointed based on the opinion of the judge and their own interest with no special training or anything like that?
Well, I think the idea is that over time, because they meet, you know, every 11 weeks and they sit for a week and they hear all these cases, and over the years they develop this expertise. But yes, of course, I mean, the fact that they come into the job without necessarily having any particular knowledge about national security and they're entrusted to start rendering decisions from day one, yes, to some degree, that does undercut it. I mean, to the same extent that it undercuts the argument that national security is somehow different from everything else, that people come into the executive branch who have no background in national security. And they come into the intelligence community and they get a clearance and they do work in this area. You know, people in their 20s who on their, you know, third day on the job are dealing with classified material. So it really is. I mean, I think the notion that is, I'm not saying that national security isn't incredibly important. I think it's incredibly high stakes. But the idea that it's different in kind in terms of the ability to understand what's involved in national security judgments, that I think really sort of lacks any basis.
Do you worry that by cordoning these judges off, we're losing something in terms of accountability or quality or anything like that?
I think the main problem is the secrecy of the entire process and the fact that these judges, in general, hear only from one party, which is the government. And that was true for decades until 2015. When Congress created a panel of advocates, and these are lawyers who are basically pre-cleared and pre-chosen, who can be part of the proceedings and represent a perspective other than the government's if the court allows them to. And this is in particularly significant cases. I think that is important. I think it's a good thing that it happened, but it still happens in a very, very small number of cases. And it's still the case that the judges in the FISA court are oriented toward hearing from the government. That's what's happened for decades, and that's how they approach these cases. I think that's problematic, not only because there are other arguments that they're not hearing and other facts that they might not be hearing, but also because it puts them in a very strange position. I mean, ordinarily, a judge is acting as a neutral arbitrator between two opposing parties. But when there's only one party, if the court rules against that party, then the court has in essence become the opposing party. The court has become the opposition. And that's a very uncomfortable role for judges. So they come into this process, I think, predisposed to try to find a way to get to yes. And that's not really the right role for a court.
This is so interesting. So there's this cadre of lawyers that will argue on behalf of people, obviously not with the knowledge of the people themselves, because the whole point of it is to be secret so that they don't know that they're going to be surveyed if they decide to go forward. But so these advocates come in and argue interests and facts in general on behalf of the absent people?
Not on behalf of the absent people. They are amici. That's amici curiae, which means friends of the court. So they are there to advocate an independent perspective. And the statute that sets up this panel basically says that they can be called in as representatives to discuss technological issues, legal issues, factual issues, civil rights and civil liberties is one of the issues that they might be presenting, but it's not necessarily the only one. In practice, I think they have seen their role and their mandate as to some degree offering some pushback to the arguments that the government puts before the court. So in some ways, their arguments tend to be aligned, one would think, with the interests of the target who is unaware of these proceedings, but they are not truly representing that person.
And who decides whether they're going to have one of those people called in or not?
Right. So in cases that are considered to be significant, that are considered to have a significant or novel issue of law being placed before the court, the statute says that they should be used and that they should participate unless the court issues a written finding that their participation is not appropriate. So basically what will happen is the court will say, you know, this is significant or it's not significant, so we're having an amicus in this case, or we find that having an amicus is not appropriate because whatever the reason, you know, so far the court has actually been pretty good about appointing amici and using their expertise in cases that are clearly significant. There have been a couple of cases in which the court has said, or the particular judge in that case has said, I'm good. I think participation of the amicus is not appropriate because I basically think I know the answer to this one already, which is probably not what Congress meant by not appropriate. But for the most part, I think the system has worked fairly well. One of the problems is that the amici have no right to appeal the decision by the individual FISA judge. And so if the FISA court judge rules for the government, they're done. Whereas if the FISA court rules against the government can appeal to what's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, which is basically an appellate version of the FISA court. So, you know, if there were some way for the amici to appeal cases that go in favor of the government, that would be very helpful.
Critics of the FISA system say that the court's just a rubber stamp because virtually every request that the government makes is approved. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, I don't think the court is a rubber stamp, actually. I know a lot of the judges who have been on the court, and I just don't think that that fairly describes them. But I do think that they see their job as getting to yes. And that is something I have heard from National Security Division lawyers at the Department of Justice who have appeared before the court, and they have said, yes, that really is how the court approaches this. So if the government submits an application to conduct surveillance and that application is deficient, if you were in a regular court, the court would deny it. But in the FISA court, the staff of that court will get back to the government lawyers and say, hey, we see some problems. Maybe you could do this. They'll work together to modify the application. They'll basically collaborate in order to get to a point where the court can approve the application. And again, that's really not the proper role for a court. And it really puts the court in a position of being an ally of the party that it's supposed to be reviewing impartially and adjudicating rather than collaborating.
So it's not a rubber stamp in the sense that they really do care about the quality of the verdicts that they're issuing from a legal perspective, but they're allied in the sense that they really just want to actively help the government to get as many of these requests granted as possible?
I think that's right. And I think, as with many national security cases, the judges of the FISA court at times feel that the government has them over a barrel because the government attorneys will come in and say, this is absolutely critical to national security that you allow us to do this thing. And even if it goes against the judge's sort of better instincts, or even if they're not totally convinced on the proof, they are always going to err on the side of granting the government the authority it's asking for when it makes that claim. And so, again, I just think that there is a culture of deference to the executive branch and issues of national security that goes further than what's warranted. I'm not saying there shouldn't be any deference to the executive branch's judgments in national security. There should be some, but I think it's really the courts have become too much of an afterthought, and they're not quite rigorous enough in questioning the government on some of these things.
What's the legal reasoning as to why the executive branch deserves any deference at all?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's an issue of constitutional separation of powers, that issues of national security are, for the most part, entrusted to the political branches, not just the executive branch, also Congress, but that there are some, you know, inherently political aspects to national security decisions that the courts are not in a great position to review. There is something to that argument. There's another argument that the executive branch has greater competencies and greater expertise in national security. The executive branch can, you know, act with quickness, with secrecy. It has a sort of well of expertise among the agencies that specialize in these areas. So there are also issues of competence as well as separation of powers issues. And I think, you know, because of these factors, some deference to the executive branch on national security is appropriate. But time and again, we've seen courts turn this deference into somewhat of a blank check for the executive branch, and we've seen that with the FISA court as well.
If you had carte blanche to reform the system, what would you do and why?
Oh, if I had carte blanche. I think in my ideal scenario, I would want to go back to the original FISA system in which when a foreigner is in contact with an American, the FISA court has to weigh in each individual case and has to give permission based on probable cause that the target is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. That would be sort of, for me, the ideal scenario. But I think that that is extremely unlikely to happen as a political matter. I do think politically there is some appetite at this point to see the FISA system reformed, to see greater protections added, to see the scope of surveillance narrowed. And I think there are many ways in which that could be done. I think probably the most important parts of that are to really narrow the scope of who can be a permissible target so that it's not just any foreigner overseas, but it has to be someone who we reasonably believe poses some kind of a threat to the United States or to U.S. interests. And I think that would go a long way toward reducing the mass collection of communications among completely innocent people. And then I think that if you look at how the communications are handled on the back end, I think we need some tighter limits on that as well. When someone's communications are intercepted incidentally, when that person is not the target, those communications should be purged as soon as they're recognized. There shouldn't be an ability to hold on to them for years, as is the case now. And certainly, if the government wants to find information about Americans, wants to comb through this data to look for the phone calls and the emails of particular Americans, the government should have to get a warrant to do that. There should be no circumstance in which the government can read an American's emails, listen to their phone calls, without having first gotten a warrant.
Liza, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Now it's time for a feature we call Recommended Reading. There's so much being written about the Trump administration, it's hard to stay on top of it all. So every week I pick out a couple of must-read stories. This week we've got something old and something new. First, we have Julia Yaffe's classic Politico profile of Carter Page, entitled The Mystery of Donald Trump's Man in Moscow, which came out last September. Yaffe paints Page as an aching pit of neediness, desperate for someone, anyone, to affirm his self-image as a player in Russian energy. In retrospect, you can see how that made him an easy mark for spies who promised to launch his career in exchange for information. The new piece is something you're going to want to bookmark and refer to when following the Trump administration's actions on North Korea, Syria, and Afghanistan. It's called The Real Factions of Trump Land and U.S. Foreign Policy by Emma Ashford of War on the Rocks. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, BEYERSTEIN, on Twitter. See you next week.